This is a production of Cornell University.
I want to welcome you to the last event in the Department of English program in Creative Writing Reading Series. This series has been made possible by the generosity of two anonymous Cornell University alums, and on behalf of the Creative Writing Program and the Department of English, I want to express our gratitude to them. Over the past 5 years, the series has provided many memorable moments, and the series has been a lavish gift not only to the program and the department, but also to the university and the Ithaca community. So great thanks again to our kind anonymous patrons. I also want to thank Marianne Marsh for all her work this year, helping us with the reading series, and most especially Karen Kuche, who has done a heroic job organizing the reading series, a backbreaking job. Our guest today, Laura Furman, has had a distinguished career as teacher, editor, and a writer. She recently retired after 28 years teaching in the English department at the University of Texas at Austin, where she was the Susan Taylor McDaniel Regents Professor of Creative Writing in what is one of the most prestigious creative writing programs in the country. Laura is the founding editor of the literary quarterly American Short Fiction, which is still going strong down in Austin, Texas. And since 1992, Laura has been the series editor of the annual Penn O. Henry Prize Story Anthologies. I just got mine yesterday. But it is as a fiction writer that she comes to us today. Laura is the author of the story collections Drinking with the Cook, The Glass House, and Watch Time Fly. She's the author of two novels, Tuxedo Park and The Shadow Line, and the author of a haunting memoir, Ordinary Paradise. Her stories have appeared in many magazines, both big and little, including The New Yorker, Plowshares, Yale Review, Subtropics, Antioch Review, and Southwest Review. Laura's been a Guggenheim Fellow and winner of the Dobie Pisano Fellowship and the Jesse Jones Award from the Texas Institute of Letters. As a little magazine editor and as a teacher whose academic interests include the contemporary American short story, I'm particularly delighted that Laura will be reading from her terrific new collection of stories, The Mother Who Stayed. This is a book whose structure and interwoven thematic concerns takes the whole conception of a short story collection to another level, and I believe Laura will have some things to say about the structure of the book. This is a really good book. You should buy it. In a recent review of the book for the San Francisco Chronicle, Alan Chews says this about the stories. Some stories stay with you in your reader's memory, a part of our brain that can sometimes produce recollections stronger than those of actual experience. Some stories slip away from you almost at once. Laura Furman writes stories of the first variety. I think Alan Chews is correct in that observation, but what he doesn't say is why Laura's stories stay with you. Like the work of some other prominent contemporary short story writers, most notably Alice Munro, Lily Tuck, Judy Troy, and Antonia Nelson, writers whose story announced themselves an unmistakable voice, a Laura Furman story is instantly recognizable as a Furman story, and for three reasons. The penetrating and often loving characterizations, even the most minor of characters, is vividly herself in a Furman story. The stylistic virtuosity of the stories, a sometimes lyrical but always lucid and precise prose rendering that gives the stories their singular texture. And third, the organic quality of the plots of her stories. That is, the events of the stories grow out of the gestures and desires of the characters. Action is not imposed upon the characters. For those of us who love the short story form, The Mother Who Stayed is a cause for celebration, and we're fortunate to have this master of the genre here with us today. Please join me in welcoming Laura Furman.
That was a wonderful introduction. I hope I'm worthy of it. So I'd like to thank Michael for the introduction and to thank the faculty of creative writing faculty and graduate students who've shown me a great day so far, and to thank whoever makes snow for making snow. Now that I'm a Texan instead of a New Yorker, I don't get to see any of this stuff, so, or not much of it. And I'd like to thank Epic Magazine also, which has published several of my stories and published them very well. I'd like to thank you for coming. I'm going to read a story from The Mother Who Stayed, but I'd like to talk a little bit about how I put the book together before I start reading. The Mother Who Stayed consists of 9 stories that I wrote over a period of more than 10 years. The collection is divided into 3 trios of stories. Most collections consist of stories that one has written in a certain period of time until you kind of have enough to make a collection. And then in my previous collections, I ordered the stories so that they wouldn't bump up against each other and in an order that I thought a reader, a completely imaginary reader, would read the collection from beginning to end. I think it's reality that most readers don't do this. Most readers kind of poke around in collections and find whatever they think is appealing at the moment. But you know, you have to figure some way to arrange things. I didn't do that for this collection because the stories started kind of clumping together in different ways. I wrote a story about a biographer, and then I became more and more intrigued about the woman writer she was writing about. So I wrote a few more stories to do with that very powerful figure and what she does to other people. So that became the middle trio. But I also started thinking about the short story in general, and I tried to think of the short story as a little piece of art, and to try not to think of it in terms of subject matter or voice, but you know, perhaps the way you'd hang a group of paintings if you were going to have a show. Or what came more easily to me, I thought about music, and I thought about the way I listen to music, which is in a pretty uneducated, emotional way. I love chamber music, and I love the concerto. I love 3 movements in a concerto, and I love the way there is a theme, and then the theme comes back, but in a different way, and it's replicated, and it gets very complicated, and the new version of it raises its own issues, and then somehow all comes back together at the end. And the thing I like best about that form is not only the experience, the active experience as a listener to music, but also the fact that each movement can stand alone, that the movements don't need each other in order to be understood or listened to. And so I then thought about the short story, which because of the O. Henry I think about a lot, and also when I was teaching I thought about the short story a lot. Since 2002 I've been editing the Pan O. Henry Prize stories, and one of the things I've noticed is that magazines sometimes publish novel excerpts as short stories, and they don't mention this to the readers. And this doesn't mean it's not a wonderful piece of writing. As I mean, the example I keep thinking of is The New Yorker using the safari chapter from Jennifer Egan's A Visit from the Goon Squad. She's making a particular kind of novel when she made that novel, but she's not making a novel out of short stories. And when I read it that in The New Yorker, I thought, oh, I want to know more about these characters. I want to know what they did before, and I want to know what they did after. And then I thought, there's something wrong going on here. This is not a short story, because in a short story, you may wonder those things, but you know you have been in an enclosed world, and the movement that began has now ended. And so I thought, well, a short story has to stand on its own. That's a very simple thing about a story. And I thought, well, I think what I'll do for this collection is have short stories that do stand alone, but also group them so the reader can put together, in a way, a novella of each trio, and a reader can find the connections between the stories. So in order to do that, I kind of had to smooth out in between the stories and make sure chronology was working and things like that. And so I wanted these independent works to make connections. Tonight I'm going to read a story from the final trio in the book. The story's called Plum Creek, and it's a Texas story. It's the middle story in the trio. The other stories in that trio are The Bluebirds Come Today, which takes place in 1874 in upstate New York, but not around here, way east by the Vermont border. And then finally, The Mother Who Stayed, which is the longest story, arguably a novella, which also takes place in Washington County, New York, but more than a century later. And after I read Plum Creek, I'd love it if you had some questions or comments. Okay, Plum Creek. Dinah was in charge of herself. She did her homework and fixed dinner every day but Sunday. Not too much for a 9-year-old going on 10, not if the 9-year-old was Dinah, her father said. At school, she was in the third grade, reading books with chapters and no pictures, and mastering multiplication. When the afternoon school bus dropped Dinah at the ranch gate, she walked the quarter mile to the low water bridge across Plum Creek, where Mama's more or less terrier, Bird, waited under a live oak, rain or shine. Once Dinah crossed the creek, she was home. Dinah knew that doing things in a regular way made time pass. The minute she got to the house, she changed her school dress for dungarees, checked that the meat for dinner was truly thawing, and that they had their starch, usually rice. Daddy didn't get home until 6. His work as a county extension agent took him from one end of the county to the other. His office was all the way in Luling, the next big town. Because Mama had left them in the spring, when the bluebonnets were starting and before the garden amounted to much, the first few months she was gone, Dinah picked their dinner vegetables from the big bags of English peas, green beans, and broccoli in the freezer. Most afternoons, Dinah raced through her homework at the kitchen table with a pair of binoculars by her side to watch for a squirrel they called Nacho because his ear had been cut in a fight. Bird waited with only a small show of impatience, a twitch of her tail, her brown eyes slantwise to check on Dinah. After homework, they'd head out to see what the day had done. They inspected Daddy's flats of seedlings on the big plywood tables on sawhorses. They checked the clematis on the fence, the mountain laurel and the Mexican plum, the first to bloom each year, and then they took off around the ranch and into the woods, returning in time to cook dinner. In the brief moment after she opened the kitchen door, Dinah couldn't help herself. She looked for her mother. Dinah had no clear idea of why her mother was gone. She had memories of voices in the night and talk of money, 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 money. Once Moira told Dinah, "Your daddy's not the least bit ambitious, so you and I must do our best with second best." Another time there was a door flung open, a sudden shaft of light in her dark bedroom, and the sound of loud voices when her mother and father thought she slept. Try as she might, Dinah couldn't hear their words. Dinah pictured her mother in the vegetable garden, and when she held the image long enough, she heard Moira sighing. But her mother might as easily have sighed from being hot and tired as from yearning for a different life with a man who was ambitious and gave her first best. Whatever her mother's reasons, Dinah's imagination couldn't take her past the irreducible fact that one day she came home from school and her mother was gone. DR, Dinah's father, claimed that he had little interest in people. The world that held him was botanical. Hybrids and imports inspired his scorn. He respected the uncultivated natives. If he had his way, he once told Dinah, he'd spend his life wandering and be happy if he saw even half of the species to be found across Texas. DR had graduated from Texas A&M University, his father's alma mater in the mid-1930s. DR's father had died at an early age, electrocuted in a farm accident. It wasn't a question of whether DR would attend A&M. It was a given. He majored in plants, as he called the science of growing bigger, better, and more bug-resistant crops to feed the increasing numbers of livestock and people. And after graduation, he became a county extension agent and worked in one rural area of Texas after another. David Runhill Warren, called DR, met Dinah's mother, Moira O'Brien, when he was in Fort Worth for a convention. He married her and took her west, where there were plant-devouring cattle and money-producing oil fields, and then to counties south, where there was so much land, all of it flat, that it was like standing on a great ocean. There, crops tore up the native habitat and cattle overgrazed. Moira's family had not wanted her to marry DR. They had toiled for decades in Fort Worth, selling automobiles for a harvest of cash, and wanted her to have a businessman or a banker for a husband. In driving from ranch to ranch, small town to small town, Dinah's father became a keen observer of the landscape. Anyone who wasn't blind could see the bluebonnets and Indian paintbrushes blanketing in spring, but DR's view was keener. He taught Dinah to read the signs the plants gave in their cycle. DR's longest assignment, the one he said he would retire from, was in central Texas, Caldwell County, 30 miles south of Austin. In exchange for minimal caretaking duties, he and Moira and Dinah lived on a ranch on Plum Creek. There he conceived the idea of saving at least one Texas wildflower from what he called the three horsemen, cattle, highways, and developers. He chose Amaroxia wrightii, the fragile yellow show, and began by gathering seeds and finding the best conditions to propagate them in pots, flats, and beds. He collected the yellow show's tiny seeds and distributed them free of charge to whoever would take them. Because of his conviction that the abundant wildflowers of Texas were in grave danger, DR endured the amusement of his fellow citizens, and Dinah went through school as the daughter of a crank. One afternoon, when the school bus pulled up to the ranch gate, Bird wasn't waiting for Dinah under the live oak. Mr. Christie, the bus driver, took a look at the sky and ordered Dinah to get to the house and stay there. "Go to the center of the house," he told her. "Don't tarry. Tornado possibilities." Daddy always said that Vernon Christie looked for the cloud and ignored the silver lining, but that afternoon the sky was as green as a lima bean and it throbbed as if something wanted out. When Dinah got to the house, Bird was there, The dog wormed inside the kitchen before Dinah opened the door more than a crack. Bird hated thunder, lightning, and rain, and probably wasn't fond of tornadoes. She didn't fear snakes, though, and alerted Dinah to rattlers on their walks. Now she was whining. Maybe she could hear the tornado and Dinah couldn't. Dinah noticed at that moment how very still everything was. And then she heard a new noise, like a train far off but coming closer, the biggest train the world had ever known, bearing down on them. Go to the center of the house, but where was that? They had no storm cellar. They had no cellar at all. The house rested on cedar posts. Not upstairs, which was all Dinah's, all three rooms, now that Mama was gone and Daddy had moved downstairs. Not the porch or the kitchen or Daddy's room. Bird was whimpering. The house had two windows on each of its four sides. The windows matched up and down. So many windows, windows all around. Dinah checked the kitchen clock as if the tornado were a real train, due any minute, and she and Bird might miss it. The fur along the ridge of Bird's spine was standing straight up. Dinah ran into the hall and opened the door of the big closet. Bird pushed past, and Dinah closed the door behind them. The sound of the train was muffled in the dark among the suitcases and cardboard boxes. Dinah found a free place at the back of the closet and sat with her knees to her chin, her head touching the hems of the jackets and coats hanging empty above them. Bird leaned into Dinah, shivering like she was cold through and through and smelling like earth. There was another smell in the closet, a familiar one, sweet and brisk and maybe something sharp beneath the sweetness. Mama in the garden, brushing a drop of sweat away and inspecting the row she'd hoed with a look on her face that said her own storm of temper and discontent was coming. One day, Dinah had arrived home from school and her mother's things were gone. Clothes gone, Bible gone, and gone was the embroidered runner Mama kept on her vanity along with the jars of Noxzema and Jergens lotion and her bottle of Lily of the Valley cologne, her silver-backed brush, and the Breck shampoo bottle from the side of the bathtub. Where were all of Mama's things, Dinah had wondered, and where was Mama herself? Dinah's father didn't make it possible to voice either question. Now, in the wind and the howling of the train, in the pounding of the metal roof trying to free itself, Dinah's first question was answered by the boxes that her father in his fury and misery had shut in the closet. Now, when the sounds were bearing down upon her, Dinah was grateful for her mother's presence, even if it was just her things. If she closed her eyes and breathed in as deep as she could, Dinah might catch the train. The tornado came close, knocking down their mailbox, taking the scrubby trees alongside the road, missing the house, missing Dinah and the dog. 2 years later, Moira's oldest brother telephoned one Thursday night while DR and Dinah were listening to the Lone Ranger to say that Moira was dead. Inexplicably, she had been living in Los Angeles, and her car had been hit by a truck on her way to work. Her body was with her parents, and if DR wanted to attend the funeral, he'd better get to Fort Worth in a hurry. The church in Fort Worth had tall white columns in front. DR wouldn't let go of Dinah's hand as he walked her down the aisle and sat her close to the altar. They were just one row behind the family. And the sight of Moira's well-known features on their unsmiling faces, her long nose and the shape of her eyes, was dizzying. As soon as Dinah got settled, her grandmother turned around and called her by name, telling Dinah to go up front to pay her respects to her mother. The top of the casket was closed. Dinah took courage and touched her hand to the polished wooden surface. The coffin looked both too small and too large. Dinah couldn't decide whether or not it was a good fit for Moira, but then she wasn't convinced that her mother was inside. The sermon and the prayers were nothing that couldn't have been said of any human being who'd been born and died. Dinah and DR rode out to the cemetery in the pickup, following the hearse and the limousines, and after the cemetery, at Dinah's grandmother's invitation, they went to the house, which was grander than the best houses in their town, even though it was the county seat. When the guests left and the food and drink had been cleared away by a maid in a white apron, the family sat in the living room. Dinah had eaten too many lemon bars, but she knew better than to complain to her father. "We can offer Dinah things you can't, David," her grandmother was saying, "and we'd like nothing more than to have her with us. We've had this discussion before." "I haven't forgotten your kind offers," DR said in the accepting tone he used for the weather and the failure of an experiment. Dinah wondered when these offers had been made. DR was next to Dinah on a plush couch, dressed in his one suit, a white shirt, and the red tie he'd ironed that morning. A strand of enormous pearls curled on her grandmother's bosom. City and country, her grandmother and father might as well have been from separate galaxies. "We can educate the girl," an uncle said. He was the one closest to Moira in age, the one who looked most like her, and Dinah concentrated on his eyebrows. "Fort Worth has a lot to offer a girl like Dinah. Dancing lessons, piano, or another instrument if she prefers. We have the resources. We can send her to college in the East. She'll have real opportunity." Dinah was in no way musical. Dancing was not her strong suit. She knew they wouldn't let her keep her mother's dog, and in that moment, the after-school walks with Bird seemed precious above all else. Besides, who would see that dinner was waiting for her father? Her grandfather's voice was gravelly, like he hadn't talked in days. "If Dinah doesn't come live with us, that's the end of it. No money from this family, no trust fund, no inheritance, not a dime." Dinah's father got up from his chair. "Your offer is generous," he said. "I appreciate it. Still and all, I don't think making a rich orphan of Dinah is any solution." Only then did DR look at Dinah, but she was already on her feet. She gave a curtsy the best she could manage and raised her hand in a wave. She couldn't do what manners dictated and kiss her grandparents and uncles farewell. She walked out beside her father and drove with him home to Plum Creek. Thank you. The longest story in the collection, The Mother Who Stayed, is about Dinah as a woman in her 50s, as a widow in her 50s. Any questions? Yeah.
Could you talk a little bit more? I know you said it was once set in 1874 in New York State, but what is the connection between the three in that section?
I'm going to mix up kind of autobiography and the writing, but in 1972 I bought a small house in Washington County, and when I was sifting through the junk that had been left behind, I found a box of about 14 diaries that go from 1874 to 1902. I guess that's more than 14, but I found a bunch of diaries that were almanac diaries, some of them little notebooks, but they'd all been written in very carefully, all in the same handwriting, and the name of the woman who wrote them was Mary Ann Rathbun. And she lived in Easton, New York, which is not the township where I lived. I lived in Cambridge, New York, but they're very close. I assume she lived in the house and that her family had, when they sold the house, had left the diaries, because it was in the 70s. It was a time when, I'm making a lot of assumptions here, but it was a time before there was a lot of women's history being written. and also a time before a lot of material and cultural history was being written. So that the people who liked old things, they liked china and they liked furniture. Some of them liked textiles. But nobody seemed to want the paper. You know, the papers a family would leave behind. So in junk stores you would find almanac diaries and discharge papers from the Civil War and, you know, all kinds of stuff that a family had just left behind. And that's what happened, I guess. I guessed that's what had happened with these. And I opened them and read, I'd done what I could, which is something that Marian Rathbun said almost every day. And it just was, you know, it was like someone punching me in the stomach because I had a lot to do. And her mature acceptance of never being able to finish anything was something I couldn't bear at the moment. But when I left that place, having done a lot of work, 5 years later, and moved to Texas, I took the diaries with me and eventually transcribed a lot of them and read them, and then went back to New York State a couple of times to research them, and eventually found out who the family was, found Marianne's grave, found where Marianne had lived, which was not in my house, and she hadn't died in my house either. Her great-grandchild had owned my house. So that was a kind of putting together of a story, and I tried for a very long time to make this into either the search or the diaries into a full-length novel, and that didn't work. And one day, when I was at Yaddo in Saratoga Springs, I kind of, you know, hit bottom with all this. I'd been rewriting this book for years and years, and, you know, I would think every version was the best and finished, and nobody seemed to agree with me who was in a position to publish it. So I kept rewriting it and rewriting it. And then I just thought, you know, I just have to say what happened. And that's how I wrote The Bluebirds Come Today, which is mostly taken from the diary with very few imaginary things from me, fictional things. But I read that and I thought, okay, that's it. I've paid homage to this woman and to these diaries. And then I was able to go and really do something very different with the manuscript, which was to make it Dinah's story, really. And I took out of that everything about Texas, almost everything about Texas, including Plum Creek, which had been part of this, and I worked on that and made that into a short story. And then I worked on The Mother Who Stayed until it became an integrated work that had things about, you know, the diaries kind of are the star of that, along with Dinah. But only with the three things do you really get the trajectory. And the voice of the diaries really had to be in there. There's a historian at Harvard named Laurel Thatcher Ulrich, who was was an inspiration to me. She wrote a book called The Midwife's Tale that she took from, you know, from documents in Maine in the 17th century, and reconstructed not only the life of this midwife, who also was very terse like Marianne, but was able to reconstruct lawsuits and family quarrels and, you know, all kinds of amazing things. So it's this kind of act of resurrection that was kind of fatal for my fiction until I figured out a way to get away from it, but still pay homage to it. And I chose to do something that's also a little unusual, which was to keep place names and the family name. I had heard from some Rathbuns, and I knew that they weren't going to sue me. And I thought, you know, Marianne was not a writer, she wasn't a reader, but she wrote these things, and that her words and her name deserved some light, and so she got them in my writing. Maybe more than you wanted to know.
Talking about Jennifer Egan and sort of the difference between a story sort of coming to resolution. I'm just wondering if you can talk a little bit about how you know when that happens. either as a reader or as a writer?
I think it's easier as a reader because it almost feels like you know, the gears shifting perfectly as opposed to dunk, 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 you know, or not shifting. And I can kind of feel it when it happens in someone else's story. It's much harder with my own work, but what it has to do with for me is the way I write is the beginning is the worst, and I'll struggle through a draft, and then I rewrite by starting at the beginning every single day and going through as far into the story as I have time or energy to go. And I'm always trying to balance the past and the present. And the present of the story is something you can almost feel pulling through a story. And the past makes a kind of break, a little intermission, and gives you help understanding the present, but the trick is not to have too much past so you don't lose the present. And this is a balancing act that goes on in fiction all the time. I read an article in, I think, the London Review of Books that was about Jennifer Egan's novel that said, oh, she doesn't explain anything. You know, isn't that fantastic? Well, I mean, since Virginia Woolf, people have not been explaining things. There are still plenty of novels where much is explained. But I think that's a choice every writer makes. How much you're going to trust the reader. There's a writer named Hortense Kalischer who died a few years ago, and I once had the privilege of publishing a story of Hortense's, and I went at it like an editor, and she was very patient with me. And then finally she said, posit an intelligent reader. And what she meant was, just stop asking me to fill in all these blanks. You know, I trust my reader to be able to do it. And so that's another kind of balance that I do, is how much can I not say? And so far people seem to be doing all right with it.
And I was thinking about this kind of sublimity of the tornado you talked about, the train. I was wondering if you could, it was so spot on, I was wondering if you could talk about going to movie to Texas, writing about
it. Sure. My introduction to Texas was extraordinarily refined. I worked for a woman named Dominique Dumenil, who had one of the world's greatest art collections, which is now the Menil Museum, which is a very beautiful wooden building designed by Renzo Piano that's in Houston. But I worked for Mrs. Dumenil for about 7 years as an editor of art catalogs, and also the first volume of a book called The Iconography of the Black in Western Art. And I went to Texas every once in a while and would stay in her house that had been built by Philip Johnson, and it was decorated by Charles James, who was a wonderful dress designer, American dress designer in the 40s. And, you know, there was art everywhere, and, you know, Max Ernst's sculpture outside. And so there I was in Texas, right? And I started meeting Texans in my about 5 years of visiting back and forth. And then when the job ended, kind of my patience for living alone in a farmhouse in upstate New York, also coincidentally without an income, also ended. And I applied for two teaching jobs, and on one of them, interview for one, I went to Houston to visit friends, and one of my friends said, we're starting a magazine, this was like May, he said, we're starting a magazine, and if we're still in business in September, do you want to come work with us? I said, boy, that's inviting. So I did get both teaching jobs, but I took the magazine job because I would rather have been in Houston. And it just changed my life. I thought I would stay there about 10 months, you know, miss a winter, etc., up here, and then come back. And I just kept getting more and more involved and more intrigued by Texas, really. And then I married a Texan who was born in New Jersey, but he got there when he was 11 months old. And that kind of was that. And we've lived all over the state. We started in Houston, went to Galveston, and then Dallas, and then Austin, and then a small town 30 miles south of Austin called Lockhart. That's a really terrific little town. And that's when I started to learn about that particular Texas landscape and the wildflowers and the enormous richness, botanical richness of Texas. And now my husband works partly in West Texas, so I've gotten to know that part of the country a little bit too. I mean, it's very nice of you to say, but I'm always very careful writing about Texas. Because, you know, I know that people are kind of hearing to see if I do the right thing or the wrong thing. And I have wonderful people I can check facts with. Like, so I talked to a friend who's in his 70s and said, okay, during X year, what day was the radio program of the Lone Ranger on? And Ken said, Thursday. I mean, he just didn't miss a beat. It was his favorite night of the week. So... But I'm careful about that stuff. Thank you very much.
This has been a production of Cornell University on the web at cornell.edu.